Touch this morning.
This is as high as a celebrity status. Hope you don't have
for me, certainly.
And me.
Actually, really, I just thought we'd just play celebrity heads, you know. Ruth, we might start with you. If you would just like to tell us just a little bit about yourself, you know, who you are and what you do.
That's a really broad question, isn't it? At the moment, I work with a gentleman by the name of Kerwin Ray, who is probably one of Australia's leaders in sales and marketing and business training. And it's been a little bit of a journey, and actually over the last couple of months in particular, but I've worked with Kerwin for the last 4 years under the guise of being a client and having my own business. So I actually have my own business coaching and training other business owners in developing their business. And recently have decided that if I combine forces with someone that's doing it on a much bigger scale than me, that I can have a greater impact and have a lot more fun being back in an office environment, which is a little bit different. So my background prior to that, I worked for 5 years in recruitment and 15 years before that in hospitality management. So I take the nice, easy career paths. Yeah, good fun. Is that where you wanted to be?
Yeah, that's right. Over that career path, what are some of the highlights for you in that, and why were they highlights?
Wow. again, I mean, to pick out just a few, we've only got, you know, how long have we got? Keep going for a while. I think highlights for me have generally revolved around people that I've worked with, and that's been right from the start. I actually had a paper round when I was 13 years old, and that was what my first kind of started working. And I still remember to this day, and that's a fair few years ago now, that there was one day that it was snowing. I was in the UK, not over here. It was snowing, and the particular route that I did had a big... I had to go on my bike, and it was really long. And literally the owner of the newsagent said, "You're not going out on the bike from this." And literally he closed the shop and took me in the car and still paid me, but I was delivering the papers from his car. And that was kind of the first time that I saw, you know, a good boss and what a good working environment can be, and for, you know, pretty much a kid at that point. And so generally it has revolved around the people. And I still keep in contact with probably one or two or three kind of close friends from everywhere that I've worked, and that's UK right through to here. Up to very recently, some of you met Yvonne when we had the workshop here. Yvonne's been a client of mine for 2 years. As a coaching client, and when she was a finalist in the Illawarra Women in Business Awards this year, that was just such a buzz for me. So it's all revolved around people.
Great, thanks for that, Ruth. Sue, what about yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, well, I'm married. I have three children, aged 19, excuse me, through to 26 years. I grew up in a country town. Born in Bathurst, grew up in a little village called Cundletown in northern New South Wales, and then Taree, then Newcastle, Sydney, Wollongong. So that's where I've been in life. I trained initially as an occupational therapist when I left school, which I delighted in doing and found very broadening, I suppose. And I became involved in a whole lot of different work as an OT and had a managerial role for the Department of Health in that area. I became very interested in having a scientific approach, I suppose, to the work I was doing, and went back to uni to learn some research methods, and in the process somehow became a psychologist. It's still a mystery how that quite happened, but that's what happened to me. I didn't ever stop wanting to be.
You went from OT to psychology, because they don't kind of necessarily connect together.
And now I work in an occupational health setting where I do use a lot of my OT in my psychologist role. So God often has ways of weaving our paths, I think, over a lifetime that we don't anticipate. But at each point, that was a thing of saying, okay, God, what next? And ironically, just as I became a psychologist, I got asked to lead mission teams into China, doing orphanage work as an OT. So life's never clear-cut in my experience. A puzzle, but again, a God thing, I think. Mm.
So how have you sort of managed the OT psychology thing over the years then?
They're fairly complementary fields of study. I think I noticed as an OT that you could have two people with exactly the same physical injury or developmental disability, but with wildly different outcomes. And that's what made me more interested to dig a little deeper as best I could into the what helps people to do better, what gets in their way of doing better, that kind of question. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. So, Ruth, we asked you the highlights before. Over the years, what mistakes have you made and what would you do differently?
Again, how long have we got? I think my probably the biggest mistake, and I really want to qualify this because, again, from a psychological point of view, a lot of the mistakes that I've made, I kind of, when I look back now, I don't think of them as mistakes. They were just different ways that I had lessons to learn that, you know, maybe didn't work out. And I think it was with the light bulb, it was, you know, no, I haven't made any mistakes. I've just figured out 10,000 ways how not to do it. And I think that kind of sums it up. But I think when I started my own business, I kind of went into business with an idea and pretty much nothing else. I'd always had the kind of an employee mindset, like my family all work in social work or community side. I wanted to join the police force. That was my goal from being yay big. Only unfortunately, fortunately, not sure which, I got stuck in Australia rather than going back to the UK and doing my police training. So that was a change. And so when it came to, I was introduced to this whole world of business and business development and personal development, and it was incredibly new to me. And I'm kind of one of those people that I kind of go, yeah, seems like it's a good idea, and I just kind of go with things. And so I think going into business with no plan, no kind of financial backings to that, and really having to do everything from scratch, figure it out as I went along. Lots of prayer, lots of, oh my goodness, what on earth is going on? And the chorus that the guys were singing, you know, I think I can't, you, I think you can, that I was just like, yep, that pretty much sums it up. So I think that was probably the key biggest mistake. And everything else has just been challenges and learnings along the way.
That's great. Was there any others that you wanted to share? We have time.
Push. Again, it is... I kind of tried to do everything on my own for a lot of the time. And I think that's been with when I worked for someone else and in my own business, that I tend to think that I've got to figure things out for myself. And I think that I've got to manage everything on my own. And so not reaching out for help soon enough has left me feeling quite exhausted and not being as successful, and certainly feeling that I wasn't doing what my purpose was and what I was really meant to be, just because I was trying too hard and doing it all on my own.
That's great. Yeah, doing it on your own is tough, isn't it? Yeah. So for someone starting out in business, I know, you know, we have a lot of young ones who are thinking about business or have just started in business. What would you say to them? What would you encourage them to do as they're starting out?
To have a plan, to really pray about it, to really know that you're clear on what God's plan is for you, but also that you've got an actual tangible business plan, and that you speak to other people that have done the kind of things that you're looking to do, and get the advice early on, and then to go for it, to then surround yourselves with people that get you, that get what that's all about. And not surround yourself with negative people that are just there to say things aren't going to work, things aren't going to happen, it's not going to work out no matter how hard you try. Don't even bother, because there's plenty of those people around. So surround yourself with people that are going to encourage you, that are going to build you up, and that are going to be good friends to you, that are going to tell you, hang on a minute, are you sure about that? And they are going to pull you up on things, but generally are going to encourage you. And then just believe that you can, believe that you can do it and go for it.
That's great. So over the years, you've worked with people a lot, obviously, with OT and psychology. What are the main stresses that people face, that you see people with?
Well, I think humanly speaking, most of us stress when we reach a transition point in life, adjusting to loss of a child, adjusting to losing a job, adjusting to a difficult marriage, adjusting to maybe an arm injury that means you can't scrub your bathroom or play bowls or pick up your grandkids. So I think we all face life transitions, and at those transition points, often we encounter stress, and that would be a point of rejigging our coping systems or our way of viewing ourselves in the world, you know.
And with that, are there any particular, you know, we're a wonderful group of women this morning, yeah. Are there any particular stresses that women particularly face?
I think that is an ongoing issue across the lifespan. I think at different stages, excuse me, we face different kinds of stress. I think one of the most challenging stages is coming into early adulthood and confirming your identity. Who am I in the world? What am I here to do? What's my purpose? How do other people see me? So I think that early adulthood time is a fairly stressful time, as much as it's a liberating and joyful time of expanding your boundaries and discovering new things. I think the early parenting and marriage time is certainly another challenging time for different reasons. Just to tell you a little snippet, I can well remember in my first year of marriage having a lot of dinners on my own on the balcony because the right way to do things that I knew was not the same right way to do things that Dave knew. So I think early marriage life is another time of real challenge as you work out what things you took for granted as right are actually just your opinion or your family's background or how you know best to do it. So that early marriage especially is a big time of stress and redeciding how you see the world.
Just out of interest, Sue, how did you resolve that?
I think we're both very verbal people, and my husband's a very direct person, whereas I was probably previously a very... I'd be more likely to avoid a conflict than have a conflict. So I've learned how to have a conflict. And I now do mediation, which is the biggest laugh of all. And I think he's learned that his view of the world is not always how it is, that there are perspectives, there's not black and white. So I think it's been a growth process which we've both really learned from. And he would say, no, I still... He'd sit here now and joke and say, no, but I've still got it right, Sue. But, yeah, that's... Being an engineer, his background is engineering, where you get the perfect solution for the problem through logical thinking. So, yeah, we had a lot to learn about how to work with one another and respect each other's approach to things. So I think early married life is a big one. Then when children come along, major issue with workload and decisions for women about whether they'll spend their time full-time in parenting, whether they'll take on other interests, whether they'll do part-time work, whether they need to work full-time. So I think that those early years of raising a family would have to be the most time-pressured, juggling times of life and a time of great superficiality but multiple relationships for women. The women at playgroup, the women at swimming, the women at school, the women at... Blah, blah, blah. About 10-minute conversations with all of them. So I think there's some special stresses that go with that stage. And then I guess now I'm up to the next one, which is kids leaving home. And I think a lot of women around my age especially struggle with re-establishing friendships. So I speak a lot with women in their late 40s through to 60s who say, when our kids were little, it was easy to make friends. But now we're in this stage, we're not... It's harder to make friendships because we don't have this common fodder, if you like, of kids and their activities. And it's also a time of questioning, do I want to pursue those goals and dreams I never had time to pursue before? Is it too late? Can I rebuild some foundations or some new friendships or an interest in sport or whatever it might be? And then we get to my mother's era. Mum's 86. Am I going on and on? I don't often get to talk. I have to listen all the time at work. No. Just kidding. I talk a lot. Mum's 86, and at 80, Mum and Dad left their high Anglican church in Newcastle to find one that had an outreaching youth group. They wanted to go to a church that was concerned for youth. And they made that trip, and now Mum's 86. She's just lost Dad, and she's starting a ministry to shut-ins. She's having an apprentice, because at 86, she doesn't imagine she'll be doing it for long. So I got the deepest respect for her transitioning in old age and still keeping a heart for young people and families. So I look at her and think what an encouraging example she is, because she could be saying, no one's visiting me, but instead she goes, oh, you've given me that magazine. I could drop those magazines off to ladies that can't get to church.
That's great.
You know, she's looking for those opportunities at 86. So that's a gracious thing of God to give her health and well-being to do that. But, you know, I think every chapter of life has its unique and different challenges.
So with all those unique and different challenges, how much do you feel that the lifestyles that we lead today can enhance or detract from some of those things?
I think one of our biggest challenges as a society... I'm just aware of the ladies behind you, Jill. I'm wondering if this chair could go back because they can't see. Yeah. One of the biggest things I think in our society is that there's a very strong focus on individualism. And that focus on individualism is very detrimental to the health and well-being of us all. I mean, some of the recent psychological research says that there's happy hormones released when we sit and engage in a conversation with another person. And I think the biggest issue in our culture at the moment is the focus on competitive upward mobility has led people to form their identity around where they live, what they do, how much money they earn, what holidays they go on, all of which are sort of self-focused pursuits, whereas people actually benefit emotionally by being connected. And I'm often interested to ask people, you know, in my work, oh, what groups do you belong to? Do you catch up with friends on the weekend? Do you belong to any community, you know, associations? And there's a large number of people out there who are going to work, coming home, maybe having a family birthday every 3 months, watching TV, not really connected to their community. So I think the church has a great opportunity both to be a place where we can serve one another and have a sense of belonging, but also to be able to provide that community to the community, to be a healing community for the community. Yeah,
that's great. So just before we pop back to Ruth over there, how do you feel the social media has affected our relationships?
You're talking to a Luddite. I just confessed. I haven't got a Facebook page. For all those erudite people who know how to use IT, I think it's probably got its advantages and disadvantages. I think for young people, it's a wonderful way to stay connected even if you haven't got the energy to go out. So I think it forms a way of keeping in touch. And it's probably the same for people in my age who've gotten onto Facebook and tracking down old schoolmates. But disturbing things, I think, can more easily be transmitted quickly through Facebook, Twitter, sexting. People's impulsive behaviours are given an immediate outlet for expression. Whereas if you had the shits with your boss and you sat down to write him a nasty letter, by the next morning you might go, oh, that was a bit raw, better not do that. Stick it in the shredder. If you know, with the media we've got available, people can cause a lot of damage very quickly. Also think that vulnerable people are more vulnerable because of the anonymity of some of the current media options. Maybe some of the younger people are better able to talk about this than me, but that would be my point of view.
I am on Facebook and I have found it really, really useful, but I know one of the things is you do see a whole lot of horrible stuff out there and that goes around and can go viral, and a whole lot of information that actually isn't really even helpful. Like, I've just discovered that there are lots of even just websites out there that purport to be, giving lots of great advice, even on health and physical well-being, that actually are not based in any medical evidence.
Yeah, things like pornography are more accessible or incidentally accessed when you're looking for something else. Yeah. So it brings to people's living rooms the problems that they're trying to avoid with a flick of a switch. So that's a big issue, and it's not an issue that Christian men don't suffer from. It's something that, you know, we need to be aware of and do what we can to put in place boundaries that keep us safe from the negative aspects of technology as well as the utilising the positive.
Did you want to add to that, Ruth?
Can I jump in on that one? And I actually ran a little bit of an experiment with Facebook last night because I thought it might come up today, talking relationships and things. People seem to be so much more willing to jump on a negative bandwagon than something positive. And so I love Facebook. I love connecting with people, and it's a great way for me to do that and have, you know, people all over the world, and it's fantastic. So I'm certainly not knocking it. But even just something quite trivial. So as many of you know, I've just started the commute back up to Sydney. So I'm on a train every morning and every evening. And the last couple of weeks, I've had a few issues with City Rail where I've got on a train and it's told me it's going somewhere and it goes somewhere different, or it stops at all stations and all kinds of things. So last week I put something going, you know, this is slightly crazy. Come on, City Rail, let's see what we can sort out. And it wasn't a rant, but I was just kind of like, you know, stuff isn't perfect here. This is not good. There were comments and likes and all sorts of interaction happening. So last night, I thought, I'm going to do this before this morning. I actually said, thanks, City Rail, you took my challenge. This week, I've been on a train every single day, and you've got me to the place that I wanted to go. I've had one comment and six likes. And I was like, wow, that just really kind of summed it up.
One of those likes mine, I suspect.
But quite possibly. There's a few people in the room. But I just found it really, really interesting that even something quite trivial, when it was kind of a little bit more negative focused, and I did kind of put, look, I'm not being negative, I actually thought it was quite amusing. But there was so many more people willing to jump on that bandwagon.
What's interesting about that is that when you look at emotions and how long they last, when we receive negative emotion or hear a negative comment, it actually stays in our system a lot longer than a positive comment physiologically, the physiological processes that follow. So it's interesting. I think some of the positive psychologists are doing research that shows you need 6 to 1 times positive comments to negative for a relationship to be flourishing, 3 to 1 for it to be getting along okay. So that bears that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and definitely, and the same as talking with children and whatever else, it is that positive reinforcement, because absolutely it's so true. And the stories we tell ourselves as well, it's not even, it's our relationship with ourselves that when we say negative things about ourselves, that stays with us as well.
That's great. Thanks for that, Sue and Ruth. Ruth, what When it comes to, I don't sort of want to sound negative here, but I guess we just want to help people. When it comes to people starting out in business, and you did cover this a little bit before, but what mistakes do you actually see people making that you kind of go, oh, they really shouldn't be doing that?
Again, there's a few. I actually came up with sort of top three of these, I think. The first huge, huge problem that I see is people having a good idea, having a good product, having a good service, and kind of having the, if I build it, they will come mentality. So not being willing to do the marketing, not being willing to do the sales, not putting ourselves out there. And a lot of it is fear-based. You know, if I just have it, then, you know, people are going to find it. And whereas, we've got to get these things out there. You know, if I say to you, fast food, what would you say back to me? Yeah, okay. If I said, soft drink. Is Coke the best soft drink? Do McDonald's make the best burgers? No. But it's all that brand recognition. So it's not a matter of whether you've got the best product or service. It's a matter of how well you're actually taking that to market. And I do actually think that as Christians, we actually have a little bit of an issue around sales and around the whole money side of things. And it does actually hold us back in business. And I know that absolutely for me starting out, I was like, oh, but I can't ask people for money. You know, it doesn't matter. And what I've realised is it's about prospering, and it's about prospering ourselves to be able to prosper others, being blessed to be a blessing. And we're not going to get that if we don't put it out there. And it is not purely a Christian thing. Business owners do it all the time. I talk to people and they're like, I've got this great thing. And I'm like, so what are you doing to tell people? Oh, nothing. And it's like, well, they're kind of not going to know about it then. So I think that's number one, is really not having the sales and marketing sorted, and being really, really good technician, but not having the other side. The second thing that I would say is not being willing to do something a bit different. Thinking that, oh, that's the way it's got to be in this industry, or that's the way it's always been done. And you've only got to look at Harvey Norman to know that that's no longer the case. Some little kid, Coogan, can come out and knock Harvey Norman off their perch by doing things slightly differently. And Kodak is another great example. You know, Kodak actually came up with digital photography, but decided that A, it wouldn't fly, and B, it would actually eat into their profits if they started talking about it, and now they've gone. They're completely gone, a big company like that. So I think you must be willing to do something a bit different and be open to that. And leading on from that, get the right advice and the right training when you're doing that. So it's not just a matter of throwing it out there. And as I said before, I personally believe you must have a budget for coaching and for training when you're starting a business. Go and learn from the people that are doing what you do. Go and learn the sales techniques. Go and learn the marketing side. Be really good at what you do, and then go and learn from other people that are really good at what they do. So there's those, probably the biggest things.
In that, with the marketing, putting yourself out there, I know that, we often hear in the media a lot of bad business ethics out there. How do you handle that, making sure that what you do is ethical for that?
And it's interesting, actually, because I have had this conversation. I've gone back into quite a heavy sales-focused role, and there's a couple of things that I was like, I'm not doing that. That's starting off on a relationship where there's, some untruth in there, and given a script, told read this script, and I'm like, no, I'm not doing that bit. So I think being really clear on having your own boundaries, as Sue was saying, it is, in so many of these things, it really is about knowing what the boundaries are and having your point that you just don't. And I would say that, media, again, loves the negativity, loves the bad things. And the vast majority of business owners are really good people and are doing the right thing. And so I also expect that in the business relationships that I go into. I expect that people have got my best interests at heart. I expect that they're going to be doing the right thing. And I come from that kind of place of expectation rather than the lack of trust and, this isn't going to work out or what if. And that really helps. And 9 times out of 10, it's the mirror that comes back to you. It is exactly what you're expecting. And it's not about being naive, and it's not about kind of brushing things under the carpet. It's just about setting yourself and your standard and knowing your walk away point. You don't have to do business with everybody. You don't have to work for everybody. I think this is exactly the same as an employee as well. That, if there are those differences that are on a real values level, a faith level, it is okay to walk away and to know what that walk away point is.
That's great. Thanks, Ruth. You talked a little bit before about building those business relationships. What do you see is the most important things when you're relating to your clients and customers? And
Two things, honesty and authenticity are the main things that I would say. And that's across the board, as I said, within stakeholders, within companies, with clients, with suppliers, whatever those relationships might be. Communicating honestly, so knowing what the expectations are and working with those and being open and honest. If you can't deliver on something, tell people that you can't deliver. Don't say that you're going to deliver on something and then not do it. If you can do something and do it really well, own that space, take it, really be honest with yourself about that as well. If you are the best in the business at whatever it might be, with the coffee business, if your coffee is the best in the business, tell people your coffee's the best in the business and
maybe
own that space.
Is the best in the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Quite. So that, there's that. And then just being authentic. People can spot a fake a mile off. And Sue will back this up. We know with our heart much more than we know with our head. I think it's 16 to 1 that our heart communicates rather than our head communicates. And so you might hear what someone's saying, but if there's something off and there's not that authenticity, it is so much more obvious. I'm sure you've walked into a room and just gone, I just get an off feeling about that person, and then they open their mouth and you're like, I knew it.
It's that gut feeling, intuition.
It is the intuition, absolutely. And intuition is actually massive in business. All of the the top business people. They know their stuff. They work hard. They are technicians. They are reading. They're educating themselves. But if you ask people like your Richard Branson, your Donald Trump, Warren Buffett, at the end of the day where the decision was made, a lot of them will say it's just gut instinct, intuition. And sometimes they get it wrong, but the vast majority of the time they get it right.
That's great. Now, obviously not everyone here is in business, but a lot of us are working in professional fields and things like that. What differences do you see between the way men and women actually behave in the workforce? Because it can be a cause of interest.
Absolutely. And, up until this week, I've actually been the only female in a sales team of six, and that's actually been quite interesting to see that as well. I'm actually going to... Dr. Ivan Meisner founded BNI, which is the biggest business networking and referral organisation. And he actually wrote a book called Networking and Sex. It's Not What You Think. That was his subtitle, It's Not What You Think. And what he said and what he discovered, and he's done way more research than I have, which is why I'm leading to him, is that women, we're great at building the relationships in the workforce, in sales, in our own businesses. We are great at developing those relationships with other people, and we are terrible at asking for the money, asking for the promotion, asking for the rise, asking for the things that we actually want out of those relationships. Whereas men are very, very good at cutting straight to the chase and asking for what they want and lacking somewhat on some of those relationship building skills. And I think that plays out over and over and over again. And as women, we sometimes don't help ourselves because we do that and then we go, but I'm better than him. How come he's got that promotion? Or how come he won that business? I'm better at that. So we do, we do need to step into our own power as well. And again, own that, own the space, own the things that we're good at. But also realise that, we've got strengths, we've got weaknesses. The guys have got strengths and weaknesses. And even within, males, females, we've all got the strengths and weaknesses. And just being a little bit more open. And Andy Stanley from Your Move, I was listening to him yesterday, and he said that every morning when you wake up, ask yourself, what would love have me do today? And I think if we approach our relationships in business with that kind of attitude, I think it's going to move us forward.
Are there things that you notice when we're trying to explain something to one another that men and women are quite different in the way? What would you like to say about that?
And again, not just men and women. With an engineer as a husband, you're going to completely go, yep. Men tend to try and want to fix things straight away, and we just want to talk sometimes. And so we'll say, oh, there's this, such and such a problem. Well, why don't you do this? That will fix it. It's like, I know that will fix it, but I just want to talk about it for a minute. And the good things as well, it's like, hey, we've had this celebration, this win, and sometimes the guys are like, well, of course, it was logical that that was going to happen. And again, it's the emotional. And again, within it's not necessarily within male, female, it's also roles as well. People that work in IT, whether they're male or female, because they spend 8 hours a day on a help desk where someone's saying, my computer doesn't work, and they immediately have to switch into fix-it mode, that's just carries on and on throughout life as well.
I was wondering, in that, just adding to that, with communication between men and women in business, I'm just wondering how easy it is for us to run on and on and on trying to explain the where's and the why's and the how-to's of something when men are sometimes just after a piece of information, where we sometimes want to talk about how we got to that bit of information. I'm not sure if you see that a lot, but...
I have to say, I actually probably wouldn't see that necessarily as a male-female thing. It definitely is an issue. There's been a lot of research done around communication, and there's four different ways that people communicate. And people need to know either the why, so why is this important, the what are the details, how is this going to work, And what do I do if I've got more questions? And so there's these four quite distinct ways, and I think that that actually comes more into it than male-female. I'm very much a why person, so if you don't grab my attention at the start of a sentence even as to why I should actually be engaged in this conversation, I actually find it quite difficult and my mind starts wandering and things like that. Whereas there's other people that are okay to kind of listen to a bit of waffle as long as I get to some stats and some detail, which I'm hopeless with. So I think being aware of what your own communication style is and just being able to listen and tune into other people. And I don't know that it's necessarily male, female, but that could be just me.
I think that's probably answered the question. I've just noticed, and maybe it's because I just ramble on, that sometimes Brian just glazes over, you know. It's like too much information or something. I'm not sure.
I can make a comment there. I'm often working with men because a lot of the people I see are men. I see a lot more men than women, I guess because of where I work. But often I find they're very... a picture speaks 1,000 words to men. So if you draw a flow chart describing how something works... it makes a lot more sense than a wall of words. So just a little thing. Maybe it works in business.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris and I actually nearly got divorced over a map on that. And he'll kill me for telling you this, but hey, there we go. We're amongst friends, aren't we? And it does kind of answer this. And yes, for him, he's a very visual person. So for him, it is pictures and I'm very much the words side of things. And he wanted me to go and run an errand for him. And so I was like, yeah, that's cool, but I'm running late. I don't have very much time. So what am I doing? Where am I going? Because I'm actually the more probably direct, you know, down the line, straight to the point. I'm like, where am I going? What am I doing? And he was like, and he starts ferreting around for a piece of paper and a pen and starts drawing me a map. And I'm like, seriously, I've got to go. Just tell me what you want me to do. And he's drawing this pretty map and all of this stuff.
So he's speaking to you in his language and you're asking for the message in your language.
We got there eventually. So, but the worst thing was, from my point of view, when he'd finished this map, I'm like, okay, it's 2 streets away from my house. Like, literally, we live there and you want me to go there. And so I know, you're like, give me the address. I would have known exactly where that was. And I was furious. I was like, he's making me late. And I was just absolutely, like, I was, no, steam coming out the ears. And literally, it hit me as I was driving home. And luckily, when I understood a little bit about communication at that point. And he's a visual person. So for him, he was giving me the information in the clearest, the most concise way that he thought he could. And for me, it was just completely the wrong language for me. And so I actually called him. I said, do you realise how ridiculous this is? He went, well, I know you're annoyed with me, but I'm really not sure why. Okay, let me explain it. And he was like, all right, okay.
You should have drawn him a map.
I was long gone.
Feeling happy, gradual increase in aggression. Why isn't he speaking to me in words? Map!
Absolutely, yeah.
That's a great story because I think that just typifies so much of what happens quite often. Yeah. And I guess in a professional field, it's really important to understand how other people think to actually communicate with them the way that works for them.
Yeah, and there are some tips. So listening to what people are talking about, you'll hear some of the trigger words. People will say, you know, even for asking whether you've understood something, it'll be, do you see or do you get it or... are you hearing me? You know, there's definitely those visual words or the auditory words or the more feeling kinesthetic words. And so being able to hear those and mirror those back to people is going to make a huge difference as well.
We did an interesting exercise a few weeks ago with Ruth about building rapport with people and trying to listen for those words and reflect back. And it was fascinating because I knew that I used my hands when I talked, but I never realised quite how much until I was talking to someone who hardly uses their hands at all, and it was quite amusing, but it was a very good lesson actually, yeah. And really, really helpful. So that was great. Sue, so I'll just pop back to you now with your line of work. What mistakes do we make as women that really can be negative to our emotional health or maintaining our emotional health?
Good question. I think one of the challenges that most of us face is keeping a balance between the physical, relaxation, exercise, and being stationary at the computer, you know, on the lounge. I think, you know, we're in a society where a lot of people spend a lot more stationary time and less movement, less incidental movement, whereas we might have walked the kids to school or walked way down the back path to put out the washing even. We're not walking as much as we would have done in previous generations. So I think that would be a simple level, not recognising the need to keep moving in our day-to-day life for the mood benefits from that.
How would you suggest that we actually make sure that we're moving enough?
Well, I'm talking on all the things I fail at today, so I'm sure you'll be going home with
we
strong...
We teach best what we need to learn most.
Exactly. I'm not a sporting freak myself, but I love to walk, so I think it's finding something that works for you that gets you just moving. So in my job, I'm sitting down nearly all day, so I try and take a walk at least 3 times a week, and I do it in all different places on my own and with people. But everyone will find their own way. It might be, you know, stopping your car 3 blocks from your friend's house and walking to their house and back again rather than driving to their front door. We've all got to put a bit more movement into our lifestyle to boost along the body's natural biochemistry for helping us keep well. I guess a second area might be in the area of boundaries. I think that as Christians, we have God's heart for people, and that at times makes us have a vision that is expansive and good. But there's wisdom required in implementing that vision in a way that is consistent with the resources God's given us, but still full of faith. So I think at times we have difficulties setting boundaries, knowing where enough is enough, when we need to draw back to look after self in order to go out and give some more. And I think that's it's a trickier one for us as if you're a Christian, because and I think it's good that it's tricky, because we're compelled by faith that God can do great things and we don't limit what we might be able to do to serve God to what we see as our current resources. So I think that issue of learning about ourselves, what our needs are, where our boundaries are, understanding our own resources and our areas of vulnerability. And I think we sometimes ignore our areas of vulnerability, act as if they're not there, when God knows they're there. He knows we're jars of clay with his all-surpassing treasure inside, so he knows our vulnerabilities. So I think in terms of looking after our mental health, to understand where our vulnerabilities lie and to be working on our own program of healing is a good thing, but also to have faith that God is big and his purposes will be fulfilled, and that if he is calling us to do something a bit outside of what we think is doable, then he is a big God and can help us with that. Yeah.
Are there any things that you think as women that we do particularly well when it comes to maintaining our health and well-being?
We're good socialisers by and large. And that reading the emotional message or verbalising, we do well. So those are important parts. I think too, the nature of childbirth means that our priority on relationship is after God's own heart. Like the nature of bearing children, the nature of that early days of raising a child are so intensively relational that it kind of, what's the word? It's an initiation ceremony for the importance of relationship in life if we haven't got that message before, you know. And I think that's the heart of God's purposes in the world is for us to know him and to, you know, glory in his glory. So I think women often value relationship in ways that honours God. Yeah.
And, I mean, we're going to talk a little bit in depth in the next session about some of this stuff, but we live in a world where all sorts of things happen to all sorts of people. What sort of things can we do just to ensure that we manage those difficult issues well?
I think I need a clue. What
I'm thinking, I guess, you know, stuff happens.
Bad things happen to good people.
Yeah. Basically, you know, someone has a car accident, or there's a trauma, a loss of a child, yeah. or something. what are the things that we really need to make sure that we're doing in those situations?
Well, I think firstly, again, to comment on culture, we live in a culture that has a very strong blame frame going, which is, I think, in some ways legally driven. We have the highest number of lawyers in New South Wales for all of Australia, you know, compared to other parts of Australia. My son's training to be a lawyer.
Second behind California, I think, in litigation in state.
So we're living in a highly legally minds, you know, legal mindset and blame-oriented community. We're also living in a community where when people reject God, they feel they must control everything themselves. So we're also living in a community where the belief that we have to be in control is, I guess, a knee-jerk or natural reaction. So I think the first things to realise are that we're living in a world that's not... When God made the world, God said, it is good. He made everything, and there's this repetition in Genesis, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. So we have a good God who makes a good world. But there's a natural consequence of the original sin that flows down through history. And sin is indiscriminate in its evil consequences. So, you know, just as excess toxic fallout in Port Kembla might fall on Dapto, and no one in Dapto created that, in the same way, and it's not their responsibility and they didn't cause it, and it's not because they were weak or stupid or ignorant. There's a lot of negative consequences in the world that we are not personally responsible for. So I think when struggles come, we need to remember, one, that it's not karma and it's not what we're personally responsible for, and finding someone to blame will not necessarily help us get our best response to the situation. The second thing I find encouraging is, like your song at the beginning today about God being the cornerstone of our lives, that he holds it all together, is that we are created in God's image. So we have all the dignity of God somehow in our DNA. What an enormously glorious status we have in the universe as made in God's image. So no matter what struggle comes, that DNA being made in the image of God, being special to God, being part of his family line, is an inheritance we all have. So though the struggle may come, that's who we are, bonded to God, good at creation, affected by sin, treasured by God. So I think that's a starting point for getting by and getting through, but not just getting by, because the Bible teaches us that it's through suffering that God does an amazing work in us. The circumstance can be terrible, horrific, things you wouldn't want, but it's through the process of suffering and reaching out to God in the midst of us that somehow we are shaped and moulded to be more like the people God wants us to be in a world that is fallen. And a common mistake is to think that in the midst of suffering, God has departed or turned his back, or that God wanted us to suffer. It's never God's desire that we suffer, because he created the perfect world where there was no pain or suffering. But it is a consequence of sin that he allows for a limited time that unfair things happen to good people. And the mystery of his grace is that even in the midst of suffering, he reaches down to be with us, to walk through that valley with us, to be our strong tower, our shelter, our rock. So I forget the question.
I think that's pretty well answered it, though. I think that was great, because you do hear a lot. I know when disasters happen all around the world, they say, you know, there seems to be some religious nut who thinks it's necessary to say that this is God's judgment on people, and isn't necessarily always that helpful. So,
and we're not always that knowledgeable, are we? And it is a truth, isn't it, that God said, it is good, it is good, it is good. And Jesus himself wasn't spared suffering. You know, God's dealing with a world where the consequences of sin are here every day, and yet in the midst of that sin, we're made in his image and he is with us, helping us to work it through. And I think it is something as Christians we really need to encourage people not to see the consequence of sin. You know, of course, some sins we do and we bear our own consequences. If I ram my car into a tree because I'm, you know, speeding, then I bear the consequences of my sin. But some consequences of sin are nothing to do with me. Someone else rams my car because they were speeding. So it's not always a matter of and I think that's the growing in maturity, working out when we're suffering because of our own stupid foolishness or our own faultiness, and working out whether we're suffering because this is the way the world is as a general consequence. And actually being able to understand that can be helpful, because if it's not because of me, I can just trust and thank God for his goodness in the midst of a difficult time. If it is because of me, I've got something to learn. So, you know, it's a win either way.
That's great. Thank you. Ruth, just a couple of questions before we wrap up here. But how can we develop our relationship skills to really maximise our professional and our business opportunities?
Practice. I think one of the times that I've, and I guess this is probably a mistake that I should have mentioned earlier, the times that I find the relationships harder are the times, again, when I'm trying to do it on my own, and the times when I'm not making the time for God, when I'm not making the time to read my Bible, spend my time in prayer. And so we've got an awesome advantage in that we do have this access to the Bible, to prayer, to how God wants us to do relationships. And so taking that time out in the midst of very busy business, professional life, to look at those kind of relationships is an amazing starting point. And the other way is, and it really follows on from what Sue was saying there, in terms of responsibility and blame, if things aren't working in your relationships, if there's people that you know you just don't get on with, there is a point for you to take responsibility for your own attitude in that relationship. And there is also the place to not just blame, or I just don't like them because, and to throw that blame and have it all external. It is to kind of look at it. And we're supposed to love everybody. We're not supposed to necessarily like everybody and what they stand for. And so having those boundaries, that walk away point, and just expecting again that people are there, and then practicing on the other things, practice on the rapport, practicing on how you listen to people, practicing on how you talk to people, and just becoming more and more aware of when there is friction, whichever those relationships are, whether that's personal or business, because it all just crosses over. We're people, you know, we are people, whether we're business people or employee people or family people, and so what happens in one area of our life is carrying over. And on a practical point of view, one of the things that I guess processes that I learned when I was studying NLP is about cutting the ties on people. So if you imagine that everybody that you come into contact with, you've actually got an emotional cord, an emotional tie with that person. And it's at the end of the day or at the end of the encounter, being able to break that emotional cord and just allowing that, you know, people have bad days. I have a bad day. You have a bad day. And so that interaction doesn't have to carry on to the next time that we meet. So let's just break that. You know, a great thing to do when you're in the shower, just the water's just washing over you, and just allow that to take those emotional ties out. And it's not cutting people off. It's actually allowing you to reconnect with them on a different level and on a better level.
That's great. Thanks, girls. That's been fabulous. Questions. They told me they'd take some questions without notice. So if anyone has some questions, please feel free to ask them. Yeah, Mel.
Not sure that I understand sort of in terms of asking for help from people within your organisation or... Sorry, I'm... Sure, okay. Yeah, I mean, you do need to be careful who you ask for help, absolutely. And it's and there are definitely sort of times and places where when you're starting out in business or particularly in business and even in a role, you kind of in some ways want to look as if you know more than you do and that it's okay. There are still other people that you can ask for help there. And I, in terms of asking for help, have a group of people that you trust that you can then ask. Because, yeah, you're not going to reveal all of your failings and your weaknesses to everybody. And I don't think that we need to do that. But look at the people that... that know more, that are doing more, and it could be quite an anonymous thing. You know, reading articles online can be asking for help. So, you know, Google searching what's going on and seeing what other experts are saying in whatever area. I don't think that there's necessarily would be an imbalance about asking for questions, but I probably need to know more specifics. But yeah, if you need help, ask for help. But just yeah, you don't have to ask everybody for every bit of help. Does that answer that?
Just picking up on that, how important is networking for people in any area of work?
I believe networking is vital and for different reasons for different people. And we're all networking all the time. I gave a presentation for Sydney Business Month on Thursday and we were talking about what a shame it is that networking has a label. Because networking is nothing more than getting together with people and talking, really. And just you talk about whatever the common interests are, whether that's business. There are networking groups which would be more mastermind groups where you would be able to talk challenges and things like that. You know, going walking with friends is networking and sharing things. So it's just where you focus those conversations. For me, I think there's three main reasons for networking for employees and business owners. The first one is to be developing the business and doing the marketing and sales side. And although I'm mentioning it first, it's probably not the most important. The second is just getting to know other like-minded people so that you can pick up the phone and go, I'm having a bad day. Just say something that's going to cheer me up and know that you've got people on speed dial that will take your call and will give you that. And the other thing is just from understanding general business. And so whether that's from a supplier's point of view, whether it's from a government grants point of view, whether it's from what training opportunities are out and about, but being more aware and more in a position.
Great. That's great. Thanks. Are there any other questions? You haven't come up with your doozy for us, Heather.
Yeah.
there's time yet. Anyone else would like to ask a question? Look, I'm sure these girls would be happy. Oh, there is one over here. Sorry. Sorry, didn't mean to miss you over there.
Sure. Okay. Yes. Yes, absolutely. In terms of the question was around honesty and assertiveness and how that actually comes across in the workforce. And I would say when I'm talking sort of about business dealings, in terms of honesty, I'm talking like not saying one thing and doing something else. And not promising and not delivering, and that's kind of where I was coming from an honesty point of view. In terms of that honesty of communication, again, it's coming from a place of love as well, and back to that, you know, our intent counts more than technique is a big sort of, principle for business and for communication. And so, and there are going to be people that don't like the way we say things. There are going to be people that don't like what we say and therefore say it's because of the way we said it. And there are going to be issues around that. And again, it comes back to, we don't have to do business with everyone. We don't have to like everyone in the workforce that we're with. And I personally believe that when you're consistently coming from a place of love and honesty and integrity and authenticity, that will override much of that conflict. Absolutely. Changing your annoyance to love. Yeah, I think we could do write a recipe for that, and that would be awesome. So, yeah, definitely.
Did you want to add anything to that, Sue?
And deal with people who are needing to be assertive in a situation. I think what you've just said, Ruth, about attitude speaking volumes is fundamental. And I think it's true that we do get angry with people at work. Conflict happens. Conflict's a natural part of life, yeah. Where you've got two people, you've got conflict at some way, stage or place. So we're all going to need to deal with it. And I guess, when it comes to being assertive, often we fear that we'll come across aggressive or arrogant, or that our anger will flare up and sort of blowtorch the situation. Or alternatively, we take the approach of sitting on it, holding it in, acting as if nothing is happening, saying nothing to the person and going away and having a big bitch, or taking it home and feeling all tense and, you know, smashing the pots around when we get there. So we do need to find a way of getting our message across. And I think one of the key ways of getting your message across is to describe the behaviour that's of concern to you, rather than making inferences about the attitude or the motivation of the other person. So say I work in a takeaway shop and somebody's always putting the plates in my area so I can't cut up the cheese. And I need to ask them to stop putting the plates in that area. And I've said to them before, oh, can you hold on to the plates? Not yet, you know, and I've done a series of those little, well, you just hold it. Then it comes the point where you do need to have a more direct, assertive statement, where you might just turn to them and say, when you put the plates in my area and I'm still needing to cut up the cheese, it's starting to cause me stress and irritability, and I can't do my job properly. So what I'd like you to do is notice how many plates are in my area and only put down four at a time. So can you see how when you have that sort of assertive communication, you're describing the impact of the behaviour on you, and then you're reflecting back to them what would be a workable solution for you. Now, they might come back to you and say, I need six plates at once. And you may have to negotiate how many plates go into onto the servery area. But being able to say to a person what the behaviour is that's causing a problem tends to be a bit better received than, I don't like your attitude, or you're always pushing me, or you don't respect my job in cutting up the cheese, if that makes any sense.
I suggest if you've got any more questions, ask these girls during the break, which we will now take, because clearly they're chipping the wood behind us at the moment.
When you're chipping the wood behind us, we can't have our conference.
So, look, thank you. So morning tea is out there ready for you, so please go and take your time over that. Catch up with people. We'll be back here soon. Our Christian faith.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole raft of ways in which faith in Christ affects us. I guess at the most basic, our sense of identity. We all need a sense of identity, and that is shaped by our family, our interactions with other people, and our experiences in life. But knowing that who we are is a sure and safe thing because of God's desire in creating us to bear his image, I think, you know, when we understand that and live in the light of that truth, that gives us a stability of personhood that I think helps us to weather the inevitable, you know, challenges of life. Percussion.
Yeah, look, that's great. And I guess along that, how well do you think that we actually... I guess some people seem to grasp the fact that their identity is in Christ better than others. What would you say to the girls that are struggling with that identity?
I actually think, and I'll talk a little bit about this later, that what we actually feed our minds helps us to either see the world the way God does or to see the world the way the media tells us the world is. And similarly, what we feed our minds affects our mood. So if I wake up in the morning and say, I'm a child of the God who created the universe, I have his image in me, I'm dearly loved, I'm forgiven, that's probably going to, well, it most definitely will change the way I feel about myself, my mood state, compared to, say, I wake up in the morning and say to myself, well, I really need to fix this house. It's not as good as the others in the street. I've got to get this career rejigged because if I don't get that promotion, my I'm really not living a life that's successful. And those kids, I just can't whip them into line. So how we speak to ourselves affects our mood and our well-being. And God's truth, the wonderful thing about God is that he is unchangeable and nothing can take us from his hand. So there's some big unchangeables with God, and that key relationship with him is a huge foundation.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for that, Sue. And now, over the years, you hear things about psychology and Christianity not really going together so well, and I guess that's probably a bit of a furphy, really. But what would you say is really the relationship between Christianity and psychology?
Well, I think, first of all, God's incredibly psychological. I think he invented psychology, but we discover it after him. That sounds a bit wacky, but, God is a relational God. He is a God of the mind, a God of the heart, a God of the spirit, a God of the emotions. So psychologists have sought to understand what troubles human beings and how to help them, and also what promotes human beings' performance. So I think the fields are parallel. Psychology tries to understand, answer the question how, whereas I think faith answers the question why more often. And if we go back in time in psychology, it really began at a time where there was a deep belief that the unconscious mind controlled everything and that the solutions to human problems were in the unconscious mind. And there was a great deal of research and curiosity into that. And then that was followed broadly by looking at humans as being a bit like rats, that we're trained by rewards.
That's
and punishments.
Concept.
And neither of those models really, do they? I mean, the normal person in the street can say this isn't very expansive in terms of understanding the dignity and breadth of human experience, And then we went off from there to saying, if people could just express their emotion, they could just ventilate, then they could solve all their own problems. So we've had various phases of, predominant psychological mindset, all of which I guess have had a noble cause, which is to understand how to help people through difficulty. But in more recent years, with the advent of more cognitive behavioural therapy that says how we think affects what we do and our emotional status, and also, conversely, what we do affects how we think and our emotional status, that more recent conceptualization, I think, is incredibly in gear with what the Bible has to say. And then moving on from cognitive behavioural therapy to more recent focus in positive psychology has come to the point of saying when we meditate on what is good, what is noble, what is lovely, what is connecting us to others, it boosts our mood and makes us feel better and better able to perform. And a bit like Ruth was saying, if you approach people with an expectation of the good, there's a certain amount of good you get back because of your mindset. So that's been a very rough evolution of psychology, but you can see the more recent models mesh a little better with the biblical themes of what's needed to help human beings.
Are there areas where you see that they either work together or they work against each other at times in practice for you?
I just wanted to share a little something on that question about one of the things that I've been enjoying more recently in my psychology practice and which I've been enjoying Christianly is the whole issue of gratitude and praise, giving thanks. And if you read through any of the letters in the New Testament, any of the letters to the churches, they always begin with, I give thanks to God for this. I'm so grateful for that. And please pass on my thanks to so-and-so and, you know, la, 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 la. And then there's that beautiful little piece in Philippians that says, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, whatever is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. So positive psychology has come to the point where it's saying, you know, stopping to reflect on the good and mindful and bringing it to the forefront of your mind and focus is an incredibly useful way to boost feelings of well-being. And God's word says that in no uncertain terms. And I think where psychology might help will be practical ways of doing that. But Christianly, we know that sometimes we as Christians can get very caught up with, oh, I should be visiting the neighbour, I've got to read my Bible, I should be praying more often, I ought to volunteer more often at church. So we get kind of tied down in making a lot of rules for ourselves that God doesn't make. And by contrast, affirming the good that God's already placed in the midst of where you are can be very encouraging and helpful.
That's great. I mean, that pretty much answers my next question too, which is how, as you know, where there has been conflicts, how have you actually navigated that as a Christian?
Yeah. Look, I think one thing to keep in mind is that most things we do in life have an underlying set of assumptions. You probably heard the word worldview, you know, whether it's, you know, go for individualism as we have in our current society or in more Asian societies, it's what the group decides that's important, you know. So every endeavour in life has its own worldview in a way. Even in business coaching, there'd be a worldview undergirding the business practices that Ruth shared with us this morning. So when it comes to working as a Christian in a psychological framework, my challenge is to say, what is God's view of the world? What is this philosophy of treatment's view of the world? And sometimes there's areas of overlap and sometimes there's areas of great difference. But often the techniques you use may be completely consistent. So just as an example, maybe trying to think of something. For example, in the area of guilt, as a Christian, we know that sometimes our guilt can be true guilt because we've actually offended God. Other times our guilt is false guilt because we're oversensitive and take more responsibility than we ought for a situation. So that might be quite different from some psychological theories view most guilt as kind of crazy, as opposed to, you know, about our relationship with God. So sometimes you have to weed things out, but largely I think if someone was consulting a psychologist, you would expect them to respect your worldview. That's what they're trying to do. If I'm working with a gay person or a Islamic person or someone whose background is different from mine, I'm taught to respect their background. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't offer truths that I think would be helpful to them that may have a Christian resonance.
That's great because it is. I'm working with people in a very multicultural society today where there are lots of different issues that come up. So I know that, you know, there are things that say, well, oh, it has to be this way or it has to be that way and, you know, never the two should meet. But actually what you're really saying is there's actually a lot of common ground.
Yeah, there is a lot of common ground, I think. Yeah, especially in this era.
Yes.
Yeah.
So as we are working with people, because all of us, we relate to people, you know, we bump up against people all the time in family and work. And when we notice that people are struggling emotionally, How can we better help those people?
I think the work, it sounded like the work you did with Ruth on rapport was quite helpful the other week. And I think the fundamental thing is to be able to stop long enough to listen and to be willing to just be there. Sometimes people don't find it easy to articulate what's on their heart or mind. So finding, I call it parallel play. You know when kids are in the sandpit and they're digging but they're not talking much? Parallel play. Finding a way of parallel playing with that person. So if they're, you know, if they're into washing the dishes after church, just going and washing the dishes with them, being with them. So a starting point is just to connect, to try and listen. If the person's not very vocal, to actually just try and be with them and spend a bit more time with them, because often people need quite a warm-up period to being able to talk. Second thing is our heart as helpers, you know, to have the heart of being a one another in Christ, you know, love one another, bear one another's burdens. I think we're all probably quite sensitive if we feel we're being taken on as a ministry project. And in churches, often with all the best intentions, sometimes people can feel a bit that way. So I think being willing to be a little vulnerable ourselves in speaking honestly about the fact that we're not all together and that we also have struggles without sort of overburdening that person. So being willing to be a one another who's sometimes able to be vulnerable yourself. Being aware of what you can do for the long haul. Sometimes people are in crisis and we need to assist practically and in, with our time for a short period. Sometimes people, though, have long-term issues that they've struggled with for, you know, maybe a decade. So it's quite important not to take people on in a very intensive way and then wear ourselves out and then drop that person. Have a thought at the beginning about what you could sustainably offer. So if what you can do is ring once a fortnight and have a chat for 10 minutes and you think you could do that for a year, do that. Be a bit mindful that if people have undergone significant suffering and are psychologically quite challenged, they may be more sensitive to messages of being dismissed or abandoned. So think about at the beginning what you can do durably. Work as a team. Often people need more help than one person can give. And that this keeps you psychologically safe as well, because you don't develop a relationship where the person's depending too much on you. And you're helping them to grow their skills of networking, like Ruth said before, which is shown to be helpful to people. Try not to be putting a program of improvement in front of people, but try to assist them where you can to consider what their choices are, what their preferences are. And try to encourage people to take a little action, even as an experiment. Often when we get very stressed, depressed, or in the place of suffering, the sheer effort to make one change can seem astronomical. So wherever you can, if you're working with someone, encourage them to take the smallest step they could take in that direction by way of experiment, rather than everything resting. You know, if you just come to the women's conference, I'm sure you'll feel 100% better. Probably not. You know, or if you just get out of the house and deliver meals, I'm sure you'll feel better. Probably not. Have a tentative approach to trying a few things and encouraging people to take little steps, little experiments to actually try something else. I think another thing is just to be aware of the community networks that are out there, the Lifeline number. Lifeline's a 24-hour counselling service with trained counsellors and you know, encouraging people to actually be aware of the resources if they are, you know, if the crisis strikes. And as Ruth was saying earlier, being someone who's willing to accept the need for help yourself and encourage others to seek help as well. Yeah.
And you probably just touched on this, but what are the doozies of mistakes that we make when trying to help others?
I think it's very natural to sometimes be overwhelmed. You know, we start talking to someone and then they start telling us and we think, oh my gosh, now they've told me these 15 problems, how am I going to help them? And oftentimes it's just the sheer relief of ventilating that can help people to feel somewhat relieved, and sharing the burden, the bearing of one another's burdens. I think silence is a big one too, being willing to just sit with people's silence at times, because out of silence often people are gathering their thoughts or reflecting. So a big issue at times is we get a bit afraid of silence. We feel some urge to say or do something, get a solution happening, you know. So just allowing a bit of silence at times, being companionably silent, can be helpful. You know, we are people of faith, and God often heals people miraculously. And I think we often it's a dilemma for helpers. Is this a situation where God's asking us to have faith so that he might do a miraculous work? Or is this a growing immaturity situation where God's going to do a work slowly but surely with this person's full mental knowledge of the steps that God's taking them through? So I think it's quite important, I guess not to set the person up to be a spiritual failure by creating a spiritual momentum that may not be God's plan. So I don't think there's a hard and fast rule for that, other than being prayerful and respecting each person's process of change is their process of change. I mean, hands up all the people who've stopped eating chocolate in this room because they know it's bad for their health. We choose to change what needs to be changed in the time that we choose. So I guess not overriding people's dignity in their own choice with our time frame for their betterment, you know.
Just wondering, in that, as Christians, we often want people to be able to make those choices, and yet sometimes by the way we do and say things, we kind of almost force them into a choice. Mm. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I think this is where sort of supporting lightly rather than heavy duty can be helpful, like assisting a person to engage in thinking through pros and cons of different options could be one of the most useful things you do without having your own urgency to arrive at a destination. Because if we think about the chocolate thing, we've all made our own choice, haven't we? We've got information. We know it puts on weight. I know I'm sometimes comfort eating, but I still eat my Cadbury's hazelnut chocolate. So it's not that I don't have enough information, but at some point it isn't yet a priority for me to change my chocolate eating behaviour. At some point I figure a few more kilos. Women put on weight as they get older. You know? I've got my rationale for not doing it, but imagine that you thought that me stopping my chocolate eating was what was going to fix my life, and you kept pushing down that path in our conversation. That would be very unlikely I'd want to spend time with you after a period of time.
You'd probably eat more chocolate.
In fact, I probably would. So actually assisting people to think of the pros and cons with everything, and acknowledging it's their choice when they make that decision, not ours. And that's being respectful of a person made in the image of God with their own power to have authority over their own life, you know.
And I guess it's sometimes hard, because sometimes we can, I guess, hopefully have a more objective and go, look, there are some things that we can see that if they did would actually be helpful. So what you're saying is allow them to actually discover them for themselves.
Yes.
What those things are.
Yes, so see yourself as more as an encourager on the sideline, so that you're someone they can come back to think through their own ideas, consider their options. But you're not kind of like the footy coach saying, kick higher, harder, faster, faster. Because I guess the nature of your relationship within the church, we are brothers and sisters, you know. We are fellow servants. So when it starts to become a situation where one person's having power over another to fulfil that person's agenda, it's generally detrimental. And God doesn't do that with us. Think about the things in your life that have taken time to change, where God might have put sown a little seed, and then he came back and watered it through someone else, and then 4 or 5 years later, someone else heard a message and then, the light globe went off and you went, you know, this is something God's really speaking to me about. I've got to actually take that on. No amount of arm wrestling would have actually reached that point, I don't think, you know.
So we all have ups and downs. Just on this last bit here with that, how do we recognise when someone's down, if you like, has turned into crisis?
Okay, so I guess the first thing is knowing the person well and knowing their normal range of crisis down curve. Some of us are a bit more like this, aren't we? Some of us are a bit more like this, and some of us are more like this, just by temperament. So first of all, to try and know the person as well as you can and what's normal for them. The second thing is, I guess, looking at patterns that repeat themselves that, you know, obviously if someone's in great crisis, you'll see it in their physical presentation. They're jumping around with what they're talking about, unable to concentrate, talking fast or withdrawn, unable to relate, you know, the more obvious circumstances sort of declare themselves. But I would look at patterns over time and a shift over time. And it's okay to sort of say to someone, are you okay? I've noticed you don't seem to be your usual self lately. And that person can say, yeah, I'm okay. What have you noticed? Well, I've noticed that you're always rushing when you come into church and you used to be someone who was 5 minutes early. Is everything okay? That might open up a conversation. Or, are you okay? Because you used to, I noticed a change in how much you talk in Bible study lately or in life group lately. Yeah, have you? What's different? Well, I noticed that you used to lead the way, but now you're hardly saying anything over the last 3 weeks. So I think noticing, we talked about with assertion, behaviour is a very safe place to begin with people because it's what anyone can see. So it's not inferring motivation or mental health or anything beyond what's observable. And it often is a good start to finding out a bit more from that person.
That's really helpful. So thank you for that. We're going to move on. I know some of these subjects might seem a little bit heavy, but I think they're actually things that happen to all of us, and so we do need to be actually able to handle them. And so we're going to talk just a little bit about grief now. Because grief is something that happens to all of us. You know, we all have people that die or trauma happens or something happens. So, Sue, can you just talk a little bit about the different types of grief that we might go through?
Well, sometimes people are hesitant to place the word grief on anything other than loss of a person in your life. Others use the term more broadly to describe a reaction to loss. So there's a bit of a difference out there in the people that talk about grief. But if we were to talk about loss of a person in your life, it can be very similar to loss of a house, loss of a treasured relationship, even not through death, or loss of your physical capabilities through illness or injury. In terms of grief, it's very much an individual process and quite a culturally prescribed process. In some cultures, when someone's in grief, just as in childbirth, you're allowed to yell and scream, take 2 weeks off work, hang out with your family, talk about that person constantly, and to have a very intense period. You may wear black for a year to signify the loss, so everyone in your community knows what you're going through. In our culture, it's often a 2-hour service. You get a few hours off work after lunch and go to the funeral. So it's a very different process. And there's no exact right or wrong way to grieve. Grieving is a normal process. We shouldn't be thinking, oh, well, they got over their grief in a year. I should have gotten over mine. I'm 10 months into it now. Because people are very individual. And grief is essentially the mourning of a loss of attachment to someone. Now, sometimes grief can turn to depression. In about 30% of people who suffer grief, they become depressed over time. We're not entirely sure what the relationship is here, but it does seem to be something like this, that if I, say, were to lose a dear friend or a family member, then in that loss, I may want to spend a bit more time on my own, being quiet, and I might stop going to tennis on Tuesdays, or I might stop socialising with the group of people I used to socialise with, that person that I've lost, just due to being their friends more than mine. So I might stop going out, socialising, doing some of the activities that would previously have boosted my mood along. So that could make the grief process more complicated because I've then become depressed on top of grieving. Depression shares a lot of similar qualities to the grief process, but the big difference is in depression, people start downing themselves. They think that they're worthless or hopeless or helpless or stupid, and they have a very low view of their own capacity. So in grief, that's not part of the normal grief process.
Are there things that we should look out for then in that process when we are, even in families and things like that, we deal with it? Are there things that we should be sort of like red flagging perhaps to say this person has moved from just working through some grief issues to depression?
Well, I think basically if you hear people talking themselves down, and I think a second thing is that while it's good to be respectful of people's need for alone time, trying to encourage all people going through grief to have some connection time. They might be able to come for a cup of tea, not for a dinner party, or they may be willing to go for a walk rather than come for the day to the girls' day out at your place. So actually looking for more micro catch-ups with people and encouraging them to stay connected. They just may not have the physical energy to do the intensive human relating that may have been part of their normal pattern prior to loss.
And when we're with people, what sort of things should we say to those people? I don't know about you, but it's often quite hard to know what to say when you're dealing with grief in a situation, because we don't talk about it a lot in our society.
I think it's a really tricky business because on any given day, a person might be feeling angry about their loss. They might be still acting as if the person's not dead, or they may be, fully acting as if life's going forward, and they may not know themselves how you'll find them. So I think the first thing is to be prepared for the unpredictability of the journey of grief. For some people, it's a very physical thing. I've heard people say they feel like they've torn apart physically. For other people, they may feel the aloneness of it. Other people may feel the loss of the contribution that other person made to their life. They cleared the gutters and did the tax, or they were the ones that organised the pizza nights. Now but nobody's organising the pizza nights. So the dimension of grief will be different at different times. I think the best thing you can do is to acknowledge your inexpertise, to actually say something like, I'm not sure whether, something along the lines of, I know everybody's grief is different. Is it helpful for you to talk about that today, or are you wanting today just to kind of move on and talk about the garden or the Christmas presents or whatever else is the topic of conversation? To actually allow them to say whether that's the agenda or not. Some people get really annoyed about being asked how they are, and others are longing to be asked how they are.
It's picking the difference that's the tricky thing.
Well, we can't always know, and I think this is the thing, to actually say to that person, I understand it's normal not to always know whether to ask you how you are or to talk about superficial things. Where would you like the conversation to be today? Let them tell you. And you can then go, oh, I'm not being a heartless cad because I'm talking about growing dahlias. That's what they wanted to do today. Or, oh, what a relief. They've said they'd like to talk about folding up Jim's clothes and sending them to the op shop and how they feel about that. That's okay. We can talk about that, So again, I think there's no simple answer, and actually respecting that the other person would know. It's good to check in and ask them,
That's great. Just moving on again to forgiveness. So more and more we're actually hearing about the importance of forgiveness in life in general. Mm. And obviously, clearly, as Christians, it's a very important thing for us. But, you know, more and more we're hearing it in a broader sense.
Yeah.
How important is forgiveness in life?
Can I do something here? In my church, in my group, what we're learning to do is to tell Bible stories, idea being that people engage with a story. So this morning, I've been just running my eye over the parable of the unmerciful servant, and I'd just like to tell you that story because it'd be good practice for me. And I think you hear, it will lead into this question of forgiveness. So Peter once approached Jesus and said, Jesus, how often should we forgive? 7 times? Or 70 times 7 maybe? And Jesus said to him, Peter, I'm going to tell you a story about the kingdom of God. Because forgiveness is a key thing to the kingdom of God. This isn't what the Bible says, but that's my version of it. He said, there was once a king who called in all his servants to take a reckoning of what they owed him. And one man came to him who owed him 10,000 bags of gold. And the man came up to him and said, Master, forgive me, have mercy on me, because I really can't pay this debt. I don't have the money. And the king said to the man, look, you're going to have to be thrown in jail till you can pay. I'm going to have to take you, your kids, your house, your business, the lot. And the man said, please forgive me because I really can't pay it. I promise I'll pay it back. And the king had compassion on the man. He looked at him and said, your debts are cleared. I know you can't pay it. You don't have to pay the $10,000. And your debt's forgiven. And so the man actually said, oh, thank you, Master, and off he went. But not long after, he found somebody who owed him 10 bags of silver. And he grabbed this man and said, pay back what you owe to me. You owe me 10 bags of silver. And the man said, oh, forgive me, please. You know, I don't have the money to pay. I can't do it. And this man then said, you can go into jail until you can pay me back. Well, the friends of the king heard this story and went back to the king and told the king what the man had done, the forgiven servant had done. And the king was so enraged that he called the man to account and threw him into prison. So that's my version of it. Not 100%, but I'm trying to get a hang on telling the Bible as a story. So the story of forgiveness is incredibly central to the whole of the Bible and the whole of life. It's fundamental to everything. It's fundamental to our relationship with God. It's fundamental to why Jesus had to come. It's fundamental to our relationships with others. It's fundamental to our relationship with ourselves. And it's fundamental to our mental health. Because whatever we hold unforgiveness, we actually retain a negative relationship with someone. The negative thing I might have done might have, the negative relationship might have begun 60 years ago. But if I haven't forgiven that person, whatever it is they've done, 60 years later, I'm still relating to them. Every time I think of that person, the emotions that go with that negative thing, whatever it was, come back. I may even often think of that person that I had this negative event with 60 years ago, and they may be scot-free, skipping across the fields, picking daisies, while I, who've been the one who's been hurt, am holding on to the issue of forgiveness. So I think when Jesus is so strong about forgiveness, it's two things. One, if God's forgiven us, then and we are to be his image bearers, we pass on the good that we've received. But two, I think it's universal that whatever God asks us to do in his name is good for us. It's good for us to forgive. It releases us from our pasts. And it's not easy. It's not easy to forgive. Certain things are easier to forgive than others. But it releases us from the past so our mind can move forward to the future.
So what are the consequences of unforgiveness for people?
You know, can I talk a little bit about what forgiveness is? Like, forgiveness is a spiritual transaction which we receive from God. It's also a spiritual transaction between us and other people. it begins with a decision. It begins with a decision not to hold somebody's sin against them. But then the process of emotionally catching up with the mental decision not to hold someone's sin against them can take time. So we may choose, I'm not going to hold resentment, bitterness or unforgiveness against that person, but I may still feel that way. So it is a process that takes time to work on dealing with those emotions. Most times as Christians, we try and skip over the counting the wrong because we know we shouldn't hold unforgiveness, so we try and act as if nothing has happened. I did a little research project about 20 years ago where I got 80 people in churches to fill out various things about what they thought forgiveness was and whether they did it. And it really surprised me, but it shouldn't have, that like something like 85% of people saw real forgiveness is rebuilding the relationship with someone who has hurt us and forgiving, not holding against them the thing they've done wrong. And a secondary form of forgiveness would be simply not holding anything against them but not having anything more to do with them. And most people said what they did was act as if nothing has happened, not raise the issue and try to walk away from it. So most people saw the most superior form of forgiveness as seeking to re-engage or choosing to let go, but what most people did was actually act as if nothing had happened and pretty much keep away.
So you're saying there's a big difference then between what people
understand forgiveness is
and what they actually practice.
And I think, we've all been there. I've been there. I know that for sure. So I think there's a lot of emotional work in going about the kind of forgiveness that restores relationships. And not all forgiveness requires the emotional work of restoring relationships. So bus driver gives you a dirty look as you ride in here today. You can give him that kind of forgiveness that there's no relationship to be restored, you know. But someone close to you hurts you when they should have been protecting you. That's a very different form of forgiveness. But it begins with a mental decision, and then there's a process of counting why you were hurt. What I think the most fundamental thing that Christians don't do is willingly count the hurt in a way that helps them understand why that person needed forgiveness. Now, often we know vaguely, we have kind of a, we don't realistically look at what it is that wasn't done that should have been done. And when we look realistically at what wasn't done that should have been done, sometimes we find it's our expectations of what was to be done that were actually part of why we were distressed, because our expectations were out of whack or assumptions rather than real negotiated agreements. Sometimes we were truly failed by someone who should have actually fulfilled a responsibility towards us. So counting the cost of what needed to be forgiven is an important first step. And then from there we're able to tease out, what is it I need to change about me in order to not be in that position again? And what is it I need to do in relation to others in order to make sure I'm safe with others, including this person? So that process can take quite a bit of counselling and support and listening by people who are pastorally concerned for us, so that we can come through that challenging part of life, knowing what we need to do to keep ourselves safe, feeling confident that we can open the doors on relationships at the right time and renegotiate trust, rather than feeling that we have to be bottled up, never to let the same thing happen again. If we bottle up, never to let the same thing happen again, largely we're in a state where we haven't actually had a chance to do the learning that helps us not to let the same thing happen again, if that makes sense. I think that might have been very woolly. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does.
I think that makes great sense.
Yeah.
Can I just touch briefly to it? Like you mentioned trust with forgiveness. I know one of the things that's often difficult when we talk about forgiveness is the idea of forgiveness and trust.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little bit about how they are related?
Yeah. We rebuild trust after there's been a breach in relationship by steps. Forgiveness begins with a mental decision. I'm going to seek to not hold that against someone. But rebuilding a relationship takes time and steps. and steps of trust that you take towards that person, but then you see what response you get to that step of trust. So it would be foolish if we've been hurt, wouldn't it, by someone in a significant way, that we forgive them and then we just go straight back into doing the same things we always did. Because chances are we're going to be back into the same hurtful situation again next week. So we seek to renegotiate trust step by step, so that, and in those step by step trust exercises, we actually have a chance to learn a little bit more about ourselves and a bit more about the other person. So say I had a girlfriend and she really let me down because every time I organised for her to come to a barbecue, she'd ring up the last minute and say, I'm not coming. I got sick, the kids are sick, the house is burned down. Always a reason, you know. But I really valued the relationship. We'd done a lot of yards together. I would need to forgive her because I want the relationship to continue. But would I need to ring her up again and invite her for a dinner? I don't think so. I think it would be appropriate to renegotiate trust, to set something smaller, something different that doesn't cost so much for me as washing the, you know, curtains, cleaning the house, cooking the barbecue, creating the dinner, all my effort then to just be go, that doesn't matter. So I might go, all right, I want to forgive this girl and have a relationship with her, but I don't need to make myself so vulnerable as to invite her to my home, put all that effort in, if that's pattern's repeated. So I might just organise to meet her for coffee, catch up with her, rebuild the relationship, see if there's any reciprocity there, if she invite me for coffee or not, you know, and then go on from there, rather than going, I'm never going to invite her to dinner again, that's the end of the relationship, or I have to invite her to dinner again because that's forgiveness. I don't, you know.
That's great. In that, sometimes when we're talking about forgiveness, we're dealing with things that have happened and the people that have hurt us are no longer with us or in our lives for some reason. Can you just give us some tips then how do we let go of those things?
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes we have unforgiveness towards people who've passed away even and who we no longer have an opportunity to actually speak with. So letter writing is not a bad idea. Writing a hypothetical letter to the person that's in your past, telling them what it was that upset you and offering them your forgiveness. If they're living in another city, you can pray and ask God to help you to forgive them and to practice every time that thing comes to mind, that event, actually saying, well, I give this to you, Jesus. I mean, I personally find it useful to put things at the foot of the cross when they're things that are from the past, that are negative, that you want to forgive, to actually visually put them at the foot of the cross and say, thank you, Jesus, you've died for my sin, died for this person's sin, I don't need to carry that. So letter writing can be quite helpful, though. Not with the intent of sending it, just a therapeutic letter, just a blast, because in that writing you can actually say exactly how you feel. And what's good about it is that in the writing you sometimes hear yourself and you might see, oh, 3/4 of that, you know, they really did a dumb thing. But actually there's a quarter of that where maybe, you know, I'm blaming them for something they would never have realised or they didn't have any understanding of or they had no resources to address. So that's something I need to actually remind myself was not necessarily their responsibility, even though I was hurt.
Is there anything else that you would like to add to what we've been talking about? Look, we are out of time. Are there any questions that anyone would like to ask on any of those topics that we have discussed this morning? Could be.
seem to me that many people just get caught in the endless loop and they never experience the real freedom that Christ has for them.
One thought I have is that I think often in the church we, and this may not apply to your church, but it's my little reflection, we kind of treat people as if they have to get the full Bible study thing under their belt before they can minister. And we sort of have, you know, like a benchmark people have to reach before they minister. And I actually think learning to minister from the first day of being an inquirer about Christ is one of the most life-giving ways to help people overcome those negative circles. Just at the uni, my husband's working on a model called Training for Trainers, where with the very first Bible study lesson that he works with students, Australian and foreign as well, from the very first session, he says, "Who do you know who needs to hear this story? Can we pray for them?" So I actually think partly what happens is sometimes in our helping, we reinforce somebody's role as recipient rather than fellow servant in Christ. And we all have a network, a neighbour, a friend, a brother, someone in our life. So I think one of the best ways to be healed is to serve. And I don't know what mechanisms you have for that, but just to tell you a little story, I was once going into China with a group called Chinese Church Support Ministries, and we were just gathering people from across the world to do this work in an orphanage for a short period. There was a lady on my team from Germany who'd suffered terrible child abuse in her family of origin, and I didn't know this about her at all, but she'd come on this team to be part of an orphanage work, and she'd picked up this baby in the orphanage, and she'd felt God's love come through her and say to her, "This is how much I love you." And she had never experienced that love. Excuse me, you're going to have to bear my one another burden for a minute. She'd never experienced that love. She was a keen Christian. She wanted to serve God. She'd gone to the other side of the world with not many skills, you know, to be part of this little work in this little out-of-the-way place. But God, in His grace, reached down and opened her heart to His love in a way that she'd not previously ever felt loved. And she went on to actually stay in China and do some long-term work there. So I guess I tell you that story because I think very often God heals us as we go. He doesn't wait for the perfect Christian. He can use us when we acknowledge that we have treasures in jars of clay, and we all have a jar of clay. That, well, the church is not the needy people and the together people. We are all made in God's image, and we are all treasures in jars of clay. But her, if you can see her story, her neediness was great, but she followed Jesus to China, and then as she served, God healed her in a way that was so personal and so powerful. And again, her story of sadness became a source for the ministry that God wanted her to do. So I don't know whether that answers the question, but I think sometimes we need to try and get people into the place of reaching out from day one, not coddle them into a beginner's group where we kind of enculturate support without challenge. We need to do both, you know. And that's because we recognise the dignity of the person that we're working with, that no matter how weak or under under-resourced we may feel, there's always someone that God would have us reach out to. We're never in the place where we don't have a good gift to offer. And that's incredibly raising of our status. That's just my point of view.
I don't know whether that answers your question or not, Heather. There's certainly some good thoughts. Some good thoughts in amongst that, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that's the deal. If you're going to be a Christian, that starts at the beginning. That's not an optional extra you add on when you're strong enough, you know? That's right now, because unless you're a hermit living under a rock on the mountain, which I gather the person may not be, you have a bus driver you can give a word of encouragement to. Look at social networking now. You can put a story out there on your Facebook. We all have a story to tell that's our story. And my friend Marga's story is Marga's story. And in fact, I think, you know, God being such an amazingly creative and personal God has, for every one of those people, there's someone that they can speak to that they only can speak the right language to. And it's people knowing and believing that about themselves. And I think sometimes we focus on fixing things that will be fixed as we fulfill the purpose that God's called us to. And we have to find ways to do those things that bring us into the purpose God's called us to. It's true of psychology as well. You know, fixing someone's depression won't make for a fulfilling life. You have to do the things to fix the negative thinking and at the same time start going for a walk. Start having a coffee at the beach. Start reading something that you enjoy for 20 minutes every day to get some happy hormones going, working towards the life that you want to live. So in the church, we can sometimes adopt medical models of fixing. You know, I've heard one of my evangelist friends says, is the church an army, a hospital, or a family? You know, are we here? Is the business of the church to fix people up so they can go, you know, so they can get right? Are we here to have the Lord's army to go out and bring the gospel to the community? Are we a family here to love and encourage one another? Well, I think we're all those things, and we need to keep those in balance, you know.
Well, I think we'll finish up there. If you do have any questions, I'm sure Sue would be happy to answer those. And we'll just as we wrap up here, why don't we give Sue a hand? That was very good.
Dear Lord Jesus, we do thank you for Jill, who's coordinated today, for her lovely, gracious manner and making us all feel comfortable here, especially me. Thank you for the welcome that I've felt at this church today. Thank you for the women who've come to share their lives with one another, to encourage one another and to strengthen one another in moving forward for you, Lord God. Thank you for the parable of the servant that's forgiven the 10,000 bags of gold. Thank you that you offer this forgiveness to each and every one of us, Lord God. And thank you that you have prepared good works for every one of us to walk in, especially because of our history and especially of who, because of how we're made. And we just pray that we might stir one another onto the love and good works that you've prepared. And we thank you for the dignity of being your created children and having a purpose to fulfill that brings you glory. All praise be to you, Lord Jesus. Amen.
Thanks, Sue. Just before we finish up, there's just a couple of things that I would like to do.